Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome again to Syriana Analysis. I'm your host, Kerek Almasyan. As I promised you at the end of 2023, I'm going to host Whitney Webb in 2024 in order to discuss political corruption. We're going to speak about how the media tries to control information and how what we call the political or financial elites are trying to suppress certain information, how the situation was during the COVID. Can we expect the worst? What about Elon Musk's Neuralink? Let's say the recent experiment. Whitney Webb, in Arabic, we say "Raniyon an al-Tarif," which means she's too famous to be introduced to the audience.
Okay, I definitely don't feel that way.
For those who are following my channel and for the first time they see Whitney Webb on my channel, she's a professional writer, researcher, and journalist since 2016. She wrote for several websites, and from 2017 to 2020, she was a staff writer and a senior investigative reporter for Mint Press News, one of my favorite websites as well. And she is a contributing editor of Unlimited Hangout and author of the book One Nation Under Blackmail. All the links are in the description below, guys. Whitney, thank you so much for accepting my invitation today to discuss together these topics.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Whitney, I initially planned on moving with you from one topic to another to build a solid case about information control, media manipulation, political corruption, and dystopian future scenarios planned by wealthy and powerful individuals and forums and corporations. But I thought I could also start the conversation with you with the spicy news of Elon Musk's Neuralink brain chip, which is now being tested on humans. What's the Neuralink project about, and what could go wrong? Some people are very terrified about this.
Yeah, so Neuralink is currently being sort of framed as, oh, it's for people that are quadriplegic or have traumatic brain injuries, things of that nature. But Musk elsewhere has been quite open that he sees a much larger commercial opportunity than people who are permanently disabled. And, you know, promotes the product as saying things like, oh, you'll be able to access your phone just with your mind and all of this. So from statements he's made and other documentation, it's quite clear that Neuralink is not going to just stop with, you know, enabling disabled people to use electronic devices. The idea is to sort of eventually, I think, usher in the next era of, you know, what smartphones are right now, right? So we had the computer, you know, revolution, personal computer revolution. Everyone has a personal computer. To everyone also has like a mobile phone that is a computer, essentially a smartphone. And the next step for that, that they've had set up for a long time, but they've had problems with adoption of it, is wearables, wearing your smartphone and smart devices, essentially. And then after that, the goal is to have it move from being on your body to within your body. And that's where Neuralink comes in. And so, you know, they're currently in human trials, but there's other brain machine interfaces, which is what Neuralink is, that are much farther along in the clinical trial sense than Neuralink, and started a year or two ago, putting these brain chips in people. So this is something in terms of a market that is more advanced than Neuralink. Neuralink is just the best known one. And obviously there are risks there. By allowing someone like Elon Musk, who is not just developing Neuralink, of course, he is also a contractor for U.S. military and intelligence agencies, you know, access to your neurological data, you know, your thoughts, essentially. Obviously, a lot of risks there. And when you consider also that he's developing, you know, or has developed this satellite internet functionality, Starlink, which works with Space Force, works with the Pentagon, and all of this, it's assumed that Starlink and Neuralink will link together, right? And there'll be some sort of interface there, which, no, I don't want my brain connected to the same network that the Pentagon and an intelligence agency is using. You might as well give the billionaires your brain in a bag. You know, that's essentially how I sort of see the brain chip thing being going forward. And ultimately, it comes down to reality manipulation, which if you look at some of the big architects of this space. Henry Kissinger and Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, wrote a book about AI and essentially how it's going to be used for managing how people perceive reality. And of course, if you can control how people perceive reality, you control their behavior. And so, you know, between, you know, AI manipulating us, in terms of our manipulating our preferences or the information we read through censorship, but also through producing the content that we read online through ChatGPT and other things. You know, you also add the AI brain chip component to it later. The goal is to have, you know, our reality be managed in unprecedented ways by whoever controls the AI, because it's not nominally it would be the AI controlling those things. But someone programs the AI and gives it its objective functions. And those, of course, are Silicon Valley firms. And some of them may seem like independent companies, but probably the most well-known one at this point, OpenAI, which produces ChatGPT, is essentially an extension of Microsoft at this point. And so we can assume that the biggest AI algorithms and AI companies are going to at one point or another be tied to the biggest of the big Silicon Valley companies, meaning, you know, Google or Amazon or Microsoft or, you know, ones of that nature. And essentially all of those companies have the same ties that Musk has to the military and to intelligence agencies, because these big tech companies contract for them. And at the same time, they dominate political donations to both parties in ways that are very significant. So you could really argue that Silicon Valley is the de facto governing force in the United States today, which is quite disturbing when you consider some of the connections of those CEOs, most of which actually were subpoenaed as part of the JP Morgan, Jeffrey Epstein lawsuit that was settled, to sort of give you, you know, your audience an inkling of who these guys are. And Epstein, of course, himself was a big transhumanist guy, very interested in brain chips and brain science and all of this. So there's definitely a group of people here that have particular agendas they want to advance with this whole brain chip thing. But at a more broader level, and you see this with Musk too, in terms of his desire to turn Twitter into WeChat, is to essentially harvest as much data from people as possible, because the new adage, right, is data is the new oil. And so if you can control the vast majority of data, then you're, you know, like the oil baron, the data baron of the new era. You're the Rockefeller of the data era. So there's essentially monopolies being formed here, and Elon Musk wanting to create the everything app. Obviously the everything app plus brain chips and whatever is going to produce so much data that it will keep him an oligarch for the rest of his life.
Actually, my position on Elon Musk, I haven't, let's say, researched much about him, but when he wanted to buy Twitter, I was like, it was already very bad. Like, it can't be worse, right? And in terms of the freedom of speech on this platform, my profile was in the past 7 years shadow banned. You can check it. There are websites that can show you clearly that you're ghost banned or shadow banned, etc. And mine was. And when he took over Twitter, I mean, my profile boomed. And now till October 7, in October 7, I'm ghost banned again. So the previous practice has returned, something that he promised to the people that he will not do it. And he himself, we can see nowadays that he's trying to not have any animosity or any bad relationship with the Israeli side, especially after the October 7 attacks there. But in the case of that you mentioned, the data will be the new oil, for example, I also heard that the car company that he has, they also generate lots of profit by collecting data while they're just driving all over the world, right? So he's also collecting map data in different countries, geolocations, etc. Why I'm asking this, because in Syria, in the past 2 months, there were targeted attacks by Israel, and they assassinated senior Iranian advisors inside Damascus, and they geolocated, like, exact probably their bathroom when they were in the bathroom, you know, and they killed them directly with a precision missile. And my information say in Syria that this was also Musk's technology, that they geolocated his exact location, and they are using his satellites to strike Starlink, positions Starlink in Syria as well. Although Starlink is blocked in Syria. For the normal people, you cannot use it, but apparently they are collecting information by themselves and geolocating these targets. Mm-hmm. In addition to the smartwatches, I also read that in Syria after 2011, the CIA and the Pentagon, they geolocated new secret military installations and the position of senior security and military personnel in Syria through an app on their iWatches, which is about running, how many kilometers are you running and how much activities you're doing per day. But this application is actually an open source, and this intelligence, let's say, apparatuses are able to detect your place only by that app. And I was going to ask about the WeChat. You already elaborated about this, because also I was speaking with a friend who is a regular visitor to China, and he says, well, I mean, I'm very happy. It's very convenient for you. Everything in this on this app, but also we can see that such apps, which is about everything in one place. It's a data sucking applications. And it could be used probably not against ordinary people, but it will be used especially against influential people, right? Like if you're going to pay something with WeChat, they could also block your access to your finances, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, on the first point you brought up, a well-known figure in the U.S. intelligence community is a former head of the NSA and also the CIA. Michael Hayden has a famous quote about, we use metadata to kill people. The examples you gave are exactly that. One of the reasons they harvest data is to find where people are. And sometimes if you get on a kill list, which, you know, I'm sure people heard about during the Obama administration when American citizens and, you know, who else, it's not really known, right? But were added just, you know, by the head of the executive branch to a kill list. And okay, you're going to die now. But now we have this new era where like AI is adding people to kill lists, like the IDF's use of AI in Gaza, for example. And if you're using the wrong app or, you know, something from Silicon Valley that's infested with intelligence linked spyware, either Israeli or CIA linked or NSA linked or GCHQ linked spyware, you're opening yourself up to that, essentially. So probably not a good idea from an OPSEC perspective to be a Syrian or Iranian military official and use something produced by Apple, which is, you know.
Completely irresponsible too. Yes, I can see in their hands all the time. They're using Apple products. They're using all sorts of open sources applications and demos. They don't really comprehend the severity of this issue, unfortunately.
Yeah, open source doesn't necessarily mean more secure. It just means you can read the code, but you have to have a knowledgeable person auditing the code that can understand the code to see if data is being siphoned off and sent back. And more often than not, it is. Mm-hmm. And geolocation is a big part of that. And of course, Starlink at this point should very clearly be seen as an extension of American intelligence, just by virtue of things where they have set up Starlink functionality against the Iranian government's wishes in Iran, right? So that it can be used by the different groups there that receive funding from USAID and these other entities and, you know, longstanding efforts to fund regime change in Iran, whether it's, you know, Israeli or American intelligence related funds, it doesn't really matter. It's, you know, similar tactics being enabled by Starlink, right? So who is prompting Starlink to go into Iran or prompting them to support the Ukrainian military, for example? It's definitely functioning as an extension of that. And again, with people, whether it's Elon Musk or Trump or any of these people, you have to look at their actions, not just their rhetoric. These figures in particular try and frame their rhetoric as populist, as right-leaning, as supporting traditional values. And in a lot of time, their rhetoric doesn't support that. So, for example, Elon Musk has been a big promoter of essentially everything the World Economic Forum promotes, whether it's UBI or carbon markets and all of these things. And a lot of his wealth could not have, he wouldn't have been able to generate the wealth he has or had the success he has without a significant amount of state of subsidies from the government, which enabled a lot of his businesses under the guise that they would, you know, combat climate change and stuff, electric vehicles and, you know, solar panels at one point and all of that. You know, his success is intimately tied with a different type of group than the one he's trying to appeal to now as sort of being a free speech absolutist, when in reality he's doing sort of this good cop bad cop thing with the CEO of Twitter, Linda Yaccarino, who frequently talks about freedom of speech, not freedom of reach. So we're gonna ban, you know, shadow ban people again. Talking about before the upcoming U.S. presidential election that censorship is going to ramp up to clamp down on misinformation and all of that. And as far as WeChat, the WeChat model goes, well, sure, it's convenient that everything's all in one place, but it does create a lot of issues going forward. When you consider some of the ambitions for an app like this. So of course, yeah, it would enable on the one hand, some sort of financial control, financial surveillance. And there's an unprecedented effort right now to have people link their online, their government issued IDs to their social media presence. Twitter under Musk has been going ahead with that, very, you know, advancing on that front very quickly. And the firm that they use to process ID verification is linked to Israeli intelligence, which is significant, I think. But beyond that, the goal is, you know, has actually been recently laid out by Eric Schmidt, who I mentioned earlier. And it's essentially that if you are posting misinformation online, if your account is tied to your ID, then they can prosecute you for posting misinformation. Because it's not like you actually, I mean, in my opinion, they probably know who you are on social media, even if you use an anonymous account name. If you bought into Musk's monetization scheme for blue check Twitter, then they probably know you through your bank account and the phone number that you use to verify with, even if you didn't issue the government issue, didn't, you know, link it to a government issued ID. But I think it's getting to the point where they will require it. And Musk has made that intention pretty clear that the goal is to verify all humans on the platform, supposedly as a way to combat bots. And those of us that choose not to do that will be labeled bots and then be deboosted from discourse on Twitter. And that's essentially, you know, where this is going. But the idea is, you know, they already know essentially what you're saying on social media, but if they can link your government issued ID to it, then they can open legal action against you in the event that misinformation is criminalized to a greater extent. And there are efforts being led actually by the US, the UK, and Israel to do that and label people that spread misinformation as cyber criminals in the same category as hackers responsible for ransomware, for example. So in linking your ID to that, it's very problematic. And again, I'll highlight Musk's connection to the, you know, these agencies that are also pushing forward on that agenda. And this, of course, is part of the larger agenda to have a heavily regulated internet where your government issued ID is not just tied to your social media account, but to everything you do online, what you read, what you post, and all of that to profile you. And I would argue that a big goal of that is this, at least in the US, it's framed as this war on domestic terror. But actually, if you read the Biden administration's documentation on the war on domestic terror, it's not just meant to be a war on domestic terror within the US. It's meant to be a war on domestic terror between all of the Five Eyes countries sharing information. So essentially, it's the Western equivalent of what the CIA did in Latin America in the 80s under Operation Condor. It's a model for that, but in the West. And actually, the West, particularly, I think Germany in the 70s, tried to implement Operation Condor domestically, but failed. But there's been a longstanding ambition to create that same type of dissident elimination program in the West. And so, do we want to make it easy for them by providing them with all of this stuff and making our financial lives dependent on something like an American WeChat? I don't think it's a good idea, given the connections of someone like Musk and, you know, the type of power that this would give someone, because his goal is for you to be able to conduct your whole financial life on Twitter and have it be half of the financial system. And he said various other things to that effect. And if you become dependent on that, then, you know, it's not good. They can obviously manipulate and control you, you know, and I think people should hedge against that.
Yeah. Actually, the other day I was watching the video or the statement of Ursula von der Leyen in the World Economic Forum, and she said the biggest threat that faces us or humanity nowadays is not climate change, is not wars, it's misinformation and disinformation. So they take it really seriously. And I truly believe that this is my solid conviction that in the coming years, especially in Western societies, there is going to be a mechanism, even laws to criminalize thought. Therefore, lots of people that I know from people like-minded like me, they are leaving, for example, Germany and other Western societies, going to what is called the third world countries, where they find more freedom of speech there to practice their jobs, especially as a podcaster or a journalist, etc. And when we speak about freedom of speech, Musk says that he purchased Twitter to save free speech. And brace yourself, this is the longest question that I have ever written in my interviews. So he says that he purchased Twitter to save free speech. Whether he is genuine about it or not, we face a serious issue with limiting free speech and centralizing or monopolizing the flow of information. However, in our lifetime, we encountered major events that were built upon narratives disseminated by the media and politicians, which later turned out to be complete hoaxes, right? To name a few, the Kuwaiti incubators story during the Second Gulf War. Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Gaddafi is using a Viagra as a weapon. Assad is gassing his own people. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is unprovoked. The Palestinians woke up on a sunny, beautiful day and decided to attack Israel on October the 7th. We have to lock you up, close your businesses, and inject you with an experimental drug for your own good and, of course, the well-being of your grandmother and your grandfather. When I speak about these cases with people who haven't digged into the rabbit hole, they stare at me. They look at me like I'm a crazy person, and they ask me, but Kivok, why would they lie? You know, why would the legacy media lie if the political and financial elites can coerce their agendas on the people, whether we like it or not anyway?
Well, I think it comes down to numbers at the end of the day and risk management on the parts of the elites as to why they lie. And of course, they lie with the expectation that the lie won't be discovered, or at least the discovery of the lie won't be widely disseminated among the public. So it ultimately comes down to control of information, which, again, if you control the information people see, you control how they perceive what's going on, i.e. you control how they perceive reality. And like I said earlier, if you can control how people perceive reality, you can control how they behave. And yes, I think that's essentially the ultimate goal of that. So they lie because they know if they were honest about their reasons for things, particularly imperial wars, people would not go for it. You know, like, no, we don't want to sacrifice American lives for oil giants. And no, we don't want to sacrifice, you know, destroy an entire country, one of the most prosperous countries of Africa, and turn it into a place that has open air slave markets and all of this stuff just to prevent Gaddafi from issuing a gold back Pan-African currency to protect the petrodollar and all of this. Yes. Like, it sort of eliminates the justification the U.S. has relied on ever since the post-World War II era, that it is spreading democracy and freedom and nation building and all of this. And it hasn't been doing that. It hasn't even necessarily, in some cases, been doing it for the benefit of the U.S. specifically. You can point to several neocon wars, which were really done for the benefit of Israeli foreign policy goals. And actually, one of the main purposes of the neoconservative movement in the U.S. is to align U.S. foreign policy goals with Israeli foreign policy goals.
Yes.
So doing, you know, what's best for Israel as opposed to what's best for the United States. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to do that, especially, you know, in states that have, you know, a large population of Arab Americans, for example, that are not going to be like, well, we don't want that for to do that for Israel. It seems like a big sacrifice, and we gain nothing and they gain everything, things like that. So I mean, they can't be upfront and honest about it, especially with things like the COVID agenda, which was, you know, mass experimentation, eugenics tinged policies, pushing for global digital ID, tighter global governance under like the World Health Organization and things like that. Obviously, if they were open about their agendas, people would not be supportive. They have to be in a state of fear and panic. That's frequently accompanies these lies, because without the fear and panic, people are more likely to engage in critical thought and take their time to analyze the arguments. And if they're in a state of fear and panic, they will not, and are more likely to acquiesce to the policy solutions that are rolled out in front of them. So, I think, it's the lie, but it also is integrated with keeping people in particular emotional states that make them more susceptible to suggestion and to solutions they otherwise would not accept. I think a lot of what you laid out is essentially built around that. And that could not operate without the success of the legacy media. And unfortunately, a significant number of influential figures and independent media have essentially promoted a lot of the same tactics, I guess, that ultimately do the public a disservice in terms of generating extreme fear and panic, being extremely partisan, maybe in a different way than mainstream media is being, but it ultimately serves what a lot of people refer to as the left-right paradigm, where you have one of the hands, either the left or right, creating some sort of debacle, and then the other hand comes in and offers a solution to the problem created by the other hand intentionally, and then you get a policy that people would never have wanted in the first place, but it's perceived as coming from different actors when it's really the same entity.
Whitney, there is nothing funny about manipulating people and fooling them over and over again, but there is one funny element in it, and that is, for example, the CIA has lots of declassified documents classified documents, and then in a decade or two or three, they declassify it and they publish it to the public. And we can see that what they have done 30, 40, 50 years ago in a certain geography, for example, in Latin America or in the Middle East, it was complete hoax. It was based on a hoax. And they repeat the same lines over and over again today in 2024, well knowing that we know that they're lying, and they know that we know that they're lying, but they're still lying about these cases, right? In 2024. Yeah. And people are still falling for it over and over again. This is something that it's not little bit, it bothers me a lot, because I like to wake people also up and about different cases, and one of which was during what happened in COVID times. And of all the major events that happened in the past three decades, personally, I think that the corona era was the peak of what manipulation and hysteria and fear-mongering may look like. And to the extent that critical experts, for example, called it mass psychosis of the people. Shall we expect worst in the coming years? I know this is a pessimistic question, or is that already is that already the limit of what the people can accept from the governments?
I don't think COVID was the limit. I think for them, it was for them to go farther than they've ever gone before. And, based on what they learned about how people reacted to what they tried to do during the COVID era, that can allow them to, adjust certain factors and variables for future experiments and mass hysteria. So, in the U.S. specifically, in independent media, there were people that drew parallels between COVID era hysteria and post 9/11 hysteria in the U.S. And I think that's definitely fair. But consider that, post 9/11 hysteria was concentrated in the United States of America, whereas the COVID hysteria was throughout the world. So it was replicating that same type of hysteria, in the 9/11 era, it wasn't just terrorism hysteria. It was also biosecurity hysteria because of the intimately related anthrax attacks. So you had sort of the agenda for biosecurity in there as well, but within the United States. And this was an effort to see, in my opinion, see if they could replicate the hysteria at the global level, which they you know, pretty successfully did. The question is, will the same people that realized they were had during COVID, but were compliant at first, how compliant will they be in future crises going forward? And so what I anticipate is that there's going to be a series, instead of having one big event, they're likely to do a series of cascading crises that do things like drastically impact supply chains, drastically alter essential digital infrastructure, specifically banking and financial systems, under the guise of cyber attacks and all of this. So during the COVID era, there was, I guess you could call it foreshadowing of groups like the World Economic Forum saying, you know, after COVID, there will be a cyber pandemic, the consequences of which will, you know, make COVID look like nothing, essentially. Paraphrasing yes. there, but that's essentially what was stated. And now the World Economic Forum has said, well, they said in the beginning of 2023 that there will be some sort of massive cyber event that will make COVID look like nothing. And it will happen before January 2025, which now that we're in 2024, if they are correct, would be sometime this year. Yeah. And if you follow any of the sort of cyber attack narratives that are propagated in U.S. mainstream media or Western mainstream media more broadly, all the cyber attackers are blamed on, U.S. empire adversary states, North Korea, Iran, China, and Russia, right? All the hackers are from there. But what they don't tell you is essentially all of the companies attributing blame for these hacks to nation states are either funded directly by the CIA through NQTEL, or they're composed almost entirely of former Unit 8200 people, which is Israel's signal intelligence unit.
Wow.
So these are essentially front companies for intelligence saying this nation state is to blame and they are attacking us. So the next 9/11 is set to be a cyber 9/11 that has global implications.
Wow.
To sort of push us into some greater war. And it's likely that whatever the next one to drop, at least the United States, is likely to be blamed on Iran just because of the extreme integration of Israeli intelligence front companies involved in cybersecurity, how integrated they are both at the U.S. government and military level in terms of digital infrastructure and also in the corporate world. Very extensive and very significant. And Israeli intelligence for the past 20 plus years has been very open about having specific programs that have essentially unlimited funding to goad the U.S. into attacking Iran first so that Israel doesn't have to launch the first strike on Iran. When it comes to the point where Israeli leadership decides that Iran needs to be engaged in a direct hot war. And Netanyahu is on record saying things like America is easily moved, i.e. he knows how to manipulate the states for those purposes. And you have sort of the return of the neocons through Trump, who ironically campaigned previously as being anti-neocon back in 2015 and 2016. But he's obviously very firmly ensconced in the foreign policy goals like of the neocons, which is, you know, ultimately directed by, you know, Israeli foreign policy goals, as I said earlier. So Netanyahu and if Trump comes back to power, as even the World Economic Forum is suggesting is what will happen, then you will have a return to, you know, the same foreign policy team that brought you the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, that tried to do coups in Venezuela. The whole idea that Trump was this anti-war president is frankly absurd. He didn't start any new wars. He continued the same ones, and they attempted to start new wars, but did not do so successfully.
Yes.
His national security advisor for a good part of his administration was John Bolton, the most notorious like Iran war hawk of all. So to think that this wouldn't happen under Trump is, you know, you're living in la la land. You know, he is his foreign policy goals are dominated by Israel, and it's the same as the neocons at the end of the day. So if there is some sort of cyber attack blamed on Iran, which again is being the blame is being laid by these intelligence front companies, you know, it's that gives them the pretext for war. And the problem with this is cyber attacks, you don't even necessarily have to blame the nation state or have evidence. You can say any group you want, faceless hackers, you don't see them, right? You can blame literally any group you want and then sort of follow the same model they followed with 9/11, be like, oh, Al-Qaeda is responsible. Al-Qaeda is backed by Iraq and have no evidence of Iraq backing them and then invade Iraq. You know,
yeah, they could even have agents in this country, like in Russia, for example, and they wage, let's say, limited cyber attacks against their own country from Russia. And they say the location of the attack is coming from Russia. Therefore, they're backed by Russia.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. They do stuff like that all the time. And and then in we know from one of WikiLeaks's last releases, known as Vault 7, the CIA has the ability to place fingerprints of every nation state, including its adversaries, in hacks the CIA actually conducts. And part of the Vault 7 release was saying that the CIA lost control of these tools, so they're everywhere. So presumably every intelligence agency can do that. So there's really no way to know who actually conducted a cyber attack. And the bar for blaming these nation states is extremely low. Some of these, cybersecurity or, cyber analysis companies or whatever, they'll say things like medium to high probability that it was this group that we think is tied to Iran because the leader of it previously worked or his believed work history was for some Iranian state company. And believed work history isn't even confirmed or documented or known work history. And then they're like, the headline will read, Iran conducts cyber attack or hacks this thing. It was actually said during the Trump re-election effort in 2020 that Iran had hacked his campaign and all of this stuff. And Microsoft, which has a significant amount of overlap with Israeli intelligence and American intelligence, it was the company laying the blame there, again, with very limited evidence. So do we really want to trust these people about us, leading us into war? Again, if you take down people's essential internet infrastructure when we've been made so dependent on it and it disrupt people's daily life, it's easy to create fear and panic in the same way COVID hysteria did, because people don't know what's happening. Their daily lives have been greatly impacted. And where will they turn for news? I guess to what's on TV, because they won't be able to access social media platforms. And social media platforms, Twitter included, have all these contingency plans about messaging and cohesive narratives with industry partners, meaning whoever is impacted by the cyber attacks, including banks. And there's documentation of this in groups like the World Economic Forum's Partnership Against Cybercrime, which includes the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI, some of the world's biggest banks, Israeli intelligence and UK intelligence have essentially said that their goal in any of these big cyber attacks is to have their social media partners, all the big social media platforms, amplify their messaging about what's happening. And that, of course, means amplifying what they want you to see and also censoring what they don't want you to see. Right. So that's likely how it's going to play out. And they're not going to give people time to find the counter narrative. They're going to bury the counter narrative and not give people time to find it, I think, is what the goal is, and try and induce people into that same state of fear and panic. And it's particularly likely if you like me, follow how they've simulated and gamed this out over the years, because I've been reporting on these factors really since 2020. The goal is to have at least one of these big cyber attacks be on the financial system, which, of course, is very useful for the Wall Street banks that are about to have another big bubble explode. And they don't want to be left holding the bag in 2008 that creates protests against them and they're to blame. And, oh, the Wall Street banks have stolen from us. They don't want that. Hackers have stolen your money, not the big banks. So it solves some problems for them as well. But if people can't access their money, of course, there'll be a large amount of panic and we will do anything to get our money back. Give us our money back. And they'll say, oh, well, in order to get your money back, we have to do X, Y, and Z. And that could be anything from declare war on the people blamed responsible, the hackers that steal your money and your crypto or whatever, which increasingly has those type of attacks have been blamed increasingly on North Korea, the so-called Lazarus Group, which the evidence tying that to North Korea is very slim, very, very slim. So it really could be any entity masquerading quite easily with this whole Vault 7 fingerprint thing, as I mentioned earlier, as North Korean hackers. Yeah, so there's a lot of crazy stuff going on there. But another thing they may do in the event of this happening is use that as an opportunity to onboard people to the whole UN financial inclusion scheme, which is the mix of digital ID, CBDCs, and the private sector equivalents of CBDCs that don't get talked about very much. Because the idea of CBDCs, right, is that the central bank is issuing the programmable, surveillable money, but also in certain countries where certain political leaders have declared that they are against CBDCs, for example, the United States, the goal is to have essentially the same programmable, surveillable money, but instead of being issued directly by the central bank, it will be issued by the Wall Street banks and the private banks, right? So, okay, JP Morgan is going to program and surveil your money and not the Federal Reserve, even though JP Morgan and Citigroup and the biggest banks on Wall Street own the Federal Reserve in the US. It's, you know, kind of silly. But in a lot of other countries, it's a direct issued CBDC. Regardless, the idea is to have all of these programmable, surveillable digital currencies, whether it's issued by a CBDC or issued by a central bank or something else, to be housed in a global interoperable database that appears to be the database being set up by the World Bank right now called ID4D. And, you know, essentially when they have that system, you know, it's here comes global governance like you've never seen it before. But again, if there's a cyber attack panic and your money disappears from your bank account and you're told the only way to get your money back is to participate in the system, come claim your dollar tokens because your real dollars and your bank account have been stolen, people will do it. And I think that's, you know, the part of the utility for them is to have it play out that way.
Whitney, while you were, before you elaborated on this case, this was exactly on my mind and I wanted to ask you about this because I was like, if they're going to fake or not even fake a real, let's say, cyber attack and the banking system here, let's say in somewhere in Europe, in Germany is crushed and then I cannot get my cash from the bank, then this would be an opportunity for them to offer us the centralized central bank digital currencies, right? And here I was going to ask you, like, if this scenario happened, what's the safer way for the ordinary people, like, to convert their dollars, like, before it happened, to gold, silver, for example, or to cryptos?
I'm probably not the best person to answer that question, just because I don't want to be seen as, like, offering financial advice, because it's not, I mean, I just don't want people to like make a big risky choice based on like what I'm saying, you know. I would feel very bad if something happened to someone's money, you know. So I'll just tell you what I do personally. So I don't really trust long-term crypto or precious metals. I think ultimately the safest way is to build something at the local community level where you can barter, or maybe your local community wants to rally around precious metals. Everyone has enough silver to use it as a currency or something like that. But I don't think most people live in a community that's that far along. In my case, assuming that all of these financial systems will not be accessible unless I decide to engage in the digital ID CBDC thing, which I do not plan to engage on. It's a red line for me personally. You know, I've asked myself, you know, how can I set myself up for success without engaging with that system in the future? So for me, it's been, you know, I don't live in the US. I live in South America. So, you know, purchasing land is much more inexpensive here than it is where I was born. And so, you know, I've acquired a relatively small plot of land. I've built and put a house on it, and I'm working towards developing food security for me and my kids, and also, you know, working on, you know, off-grid power and all of that stuff, so I don't have to engage in the system. So essentially what I'm doing in that sense is using my money to invest in things that will keep, you know, allow my family and I to meet our essential needs without engaging in this system going forward. And that is going to look different for everyone. Maybe someone doesn't have the capacity to purchase land, but they can maybe stop renting in a city, move to a more suburban region, moved to some area where local people are more aware of these issues and more likely to come together in the time of crisis, instead of sort of, you know, a dog eat dog, you know, thing that may emerge in more intense, urban environments, right? Or people may want to stock up on food, you know, that will last X number of years in case there's a food security issue going forward. Honestly, that's what I'm doing, because I, you know, if I tell you to put your money in crypto or precious metals, I can't guarantee that they won't manipulate those markets, or that they won't make it illegal for you to cash it out on a system they don't control or something like that. So something like Bitcoin, for example, if you want to convert that into dollars or convert that into another fiat currency, you have to use their off ramps, you know?
Yeah.
And increasingly that's entities like Coinbase, for example, which are quite large in that regard. And one of the advisors for Coinbase on compliance with coming government regulations is Mark Esper, Trump's head of the Pentagon. these same exchanges are very much merging with the existing Silicon Valley, Wall Street, intelligence, power nexus. And it's best not to engage with them. I mean, there's ways you can get around that maybe for Bitcoin and some other things, but they're increasingly trying to make it more and more difficult to have privacy in crypto transactions, because the ultimate goal at the end of the day is financial surveillance. And if you take away mixers and other tools from the crypto sphere, you essentially through blockchain have something that's completely surveillable and trackable for these people, which is ultimately what they want. Precious metals to a lesser degree, but they can manipulate the price and have been for a very long time. So it's important to be aware of those things. Obviously, you know, it's those things I'm sure are better than having it like in your bank account. If you have a bank account with JP Morgan or Citigroup or Bank of America or any of these too big to fail banks. But you know, where is your money the safest? In my opinion, it's in physical assets that will keep you alive when things get really crazy.
Wow. I mean, I have friends who had similar experiences in Beirut when there was the financial crash in 2018. Mm-hmm. And people were able to cash out 30% of their money if they wanted cash right now. So you forget about 70% of your money. Oof. Or you can cash out $500 per week or something like that, maximum, depending on the number of your family members. So these things already happened, like in front of our eyes. Mm-hmm. Syrians lost billions of dollars in Lebanon, billions. And the estimates are around $80 billion because of the financial crash that happened there. And the bank said, "I'm bankrupt, guys. We don't have your money. And forget about it. If you want, we can give you 30% of your money cash now, or you have to wait till things get better." So, yeah, since you mentioned about the sustainable solutions that you are pursuing, I find it really, really realistic, this approach. However, for lots of ordinary people who wake up early in the morning, go to their daily jobs, 10 hours per day, they have really no power to invest in any other jobs to collect some money, because life has become so expensive nowadays. For example, here where I live in Berlin, the government here supports the war in Ukraine. They have to send weapons. How are they going to do that? They're printing money. It causes inflation. Then I'm going to pay 30 to 40% extra for every grocery I buy. So they're financing the war from my pockets. It's an extra tax anyways. Mm-hmm. And they're presenting carbon tax. I don't know. Like every day there is a new tax. So the people cannot purchase, right? And myself, I know that I cannot purchase in Germany, but there are alternative countries. If you guys have a German passport or a European passport, this is gold. Like really, I'm Syrian. I have a Syrian passport. It doesn't let me go anywhere around the world. So it's like you're stuck, you know. But if you have an American passport or a German passport, you can go and work and try to establish an online work for now and generate some money, and you can move to any other country. And they are one of the reasons why there are wars is because it makes also life expensive for you. And one of the issues that I wanted to speak with you today, Whitney, is the October 7 attacks, right? And there is very onslaught on Gaza. Almost 4 months after the attack, military experts still argue whether it was let it happen incident or a major intelligence failure, based on the premise that Israel heavily relied on AI to collect data from Gaza to foresee and abort similar surprise attacks. I would like to hear your take on that. On which camp are you? Is it a let it happen event, or it was an intelligence failure based on the over-reliance on AI?
Yeah, I think it was a let it happen style event. And, you know, there were a lot of comparisons made by Israeli officials at the time saying this is our 9/11, right? And for those that have researched seriously, September 11th, 2001 in New York City, people that have looked into that are aware that the same sophisticated system, not the same, but sophisticated defense systems in the U.S. all just happened not to be working that day. How convenient. And they were tied to a series of software companies, P-TECH, for example, among others, that had ties to, you know, intelligence. And involved in various things that were very suspect. Just like October 7th, there was advanced knowledge and insider trading taking place before the attacks themselves, showing that someone with money and means knew that those attacks were going to happen before they did. So foreknowledge, right? You have to consider, too, that what was going on in Israel before October 7th, extreme protest against Netanyahu in Israel over the judicial reform issue. How do you bring together a divided populace, particularly in Israel? You unite them with war, a common enemy, a common threat. In Israel, a lot of people say that Americans are the most propagandized populace. I would say it's Israel is definitely up there, if not above the U.S., because, you know, the Ministry of Education is increasingly is often run by the same people that also like have top posts in the Ministry of Defense. Naftali Bennett, for example, a good example of the overlap there. And there's a lot of, Israelis in many kindergartens and, you know, early education are basically taught that, you know, you live in an insecure place because you're Jewish and people are going to come after you. And, you know, we're a persecuted populace and all of this stuff. And Israel, since its inception in the late 40s, has been under a state of emergency continuously in its entire existence. It's never not been in a state of emergency. And so this whole like instantaneous wartime footing is sort of ingrained in this particular population and has been for some time. And so a way to stop, I think, in my opinion, October 7th was so convenient in that it stopped a lot of those problems for Netanyahu and then allowed him to sort of, unify the issues, the different factions against him, essentially, and then push for longstanding objectives of his, which include things like ethnic cleansing of what remains of Palestine, and, you know, greater Israel ambitions and regional wars with various nations for the goal of, you know, greater Israel territorial acquisition. And Netanyahu in his current government is allied with figures that want to actualize that as well, not just Netanyahu, and have been a lot more vocal about those goals than Netanyahu himself, as particularly the greater Israel aspect of it. But Netanyahu more recently has said things like Israel needs to control from the river to the sea. And all of that, meaning like all of the territory, and has, you know, even his officials ever since the, the conflict in Gaza has begun, has been very open about the goal is to essentially remove Gazans from Gaza and wanting to send them to the Sinai, resettle them in the Sinai, and all of these other agendas that have been developed, well before October 7th. My colleague Ian Davis wrote a very excellent article breaking down all of the supposed intelligence failures of October 7th and how it is very much, it seems to have been intentional. The AI aspect, did AI fail? Maybe in some cases AI does fail because there is no facial recognition AI algorithm on the market that's 100% accurate.
Yeah.
And there's some countries like the UK, for example, where there have been scandals essentially about how inaccurate facial recognition AI is. However, Israel is a market leader in this for defense. They have used Palestine as a testbed for this technology for years and years and years and years. There is no more surveilled populace in the entire world than the Palestinians. So for them to not know this stuff, and it's not just the border fence, the AI failed on the border fence. I mean, everything on their phones and all of that, the surveillance against Palestinians is just unprecedented. The fact that they would not know it was happening is absurd, especially when you consider that more or less allied nations, quasi allies, I would sort of put Egypt under its current leadership in that category. They warned Israel that this was going to happen before it happened, and those warnings were ignored. It's very similar to a lot of stuff that happened before 9/11. And of course, for Israeli officials to say this is our 9/11 is pretty significant when you consider that, you know, Israeli intelligence had its own documented role in what happened on 9/11 in the United States. Not saying they were the only ones involved, because obviously U.S. intelligence, and you had the Saudis and Pakistani intelligence services involved to degrees. But it, you know, 9/11 was something that was orchestrated for the purpose of justifying war around the world under the guise of combating terrorism. And Israel, at this point in time that October 7th happened, needed some sort of galvanizing event to sort of paper over the divisions that were threatening to split Israeli society and make Netanyahu a less polarizing figure for the purpose of pushing specific policy objectives forward that are longstanding goals, not just of Netanyahu, but the religious right extremist groups with which he is allied in his current government. So the AI explanation, AI failure explanation, reminds me a lot of what CIA officials and military officials said about 9/11 after it happened. It was a failure of imagination. It was just incompetence. You know, oh yes, all our systems failed. And routinely, governments like this want you to think they're incompetent so that you don't realize what they're actually doing and what their goals and objectives really are. Because you're just, oh, they're so stupid. Let's put another guy in power. I mean, you're ultimately, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just part of the deception to write it all off as incompetence, at the end of the day. And, if there's anything, I know after reporting on for a very long time on Israeli defense industry, Israeli AI and, you know, defense tech companies, it's that, they know what Palestinians are doing and saying. They tested all there, and the idea that they would not have any sort of forewarning. If Egyptian intelligence could pick it up, Israeli intelligence picked it up.
Yes, I agree.
And there's been a lot of, you know, in recent weeks, even Israeli mainstream media has been forced to acknowledge that the official narratives propagated by Israeli officials in the immediate aftermath of October 7th were erroneous. How many of those civilians were actually killed by the IDF as opposed to Hamas? And there's been efforts to prevent documentation from coming out from the highest levels of the Israeli military and intelligence communities. That to me suggests there's a cover up. People knew. The insider trading stuff is also pretty damning. And again, I think it comes down. I would ask the same people that are saying, was this incompetence because of over reliance on AI? How do they feel about 9/11? Was that a failure of imagination to you too? You know, I mean, I think these types of events that are so impactful in terms of, you know, the policy solutions that are forced on the populace later when they're, you know, in fear and panicking. Oh, we're being invaded. Oh, look at the incursion Hamas did, and they took hostages. When was the last time this happened? It's been decades. Oh, we can't allow a Palestinian state now, and all of this stuff. I mean, these are things that Netanyahu has always wanted, you know.
Yeah.
And I think people are naive to assume that he wouldn't endanger Israeli lives in pursuit of his policy goals and his ability to stay in power. This is a man who will kill literally anyone to get what he wants. That he wouldn't sacrifice Israeli citizens as part of that, I think, is naive, especially when you consider, too, I thought it was interesting as well that apparently one of the events, the music festival that was targeted as part of October 7th, were a bunch of Israelis that were very how should I phrase this? They were very supportive of peace efforts with the Palestinians. And that is the class of Israelis that Netanyahu and his ilk hate the most.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Near the biggest concentration camp nowadays in the world, they were dancing for peace, according to the official narrative. Yes. I mean, I just want to connect the dots in two points that you raised, Greater Israel. I want to mention this because the Israelis want to kick the Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to the Sinai. And the border of the Greater Israel is between the Nile to the Euphrates, right? And if you see what could happen next, if they kick the Palestinians to the Sinai, the Palestinians will go there and they're not going to accept to live in the deserts under harsh conditions in the Sinai. They will try to go back to Gaza. They will form a resistance, armed resistance, to go back to their country. And then Israel will say, there is a security threat coming from the Sinai now that I have to create a buffer zone in the Sinai. And sure, this is something...
They did in Syria,
mm-hmm. in the Golan. They did it in the Sinai in the 67 war. They occupied mm-hmm. it. And mm-hmm. the eastern border, which is in the Nile, what is on the eastern side of the Nile, of the Euphrates, is the American occupation forces, right? They're literally occupying that piece of land and they're balkanizing Syria. Encouraging the Kurdish militias to call for a separation, their autonomy. And if mm-hmm. you see the plan for Greater Israel, Israel says that their border on the eastern side should be with Kurdistan, with the Kurds. And mm-hmm. when you just combine these issues together, you will see that, yes, some people say it's a conspiracy theory, but there is an actual political military work is being done to achieve this goal as mm-hmm. well on the ground. The second thing you mentioned, the Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attacks, not completely, but they had a role in it. I want to mention this character, Bandar bin Sultan, right? He was the ambassador of the Saudis in Washington, D.C. when it happened. Mm-hmm. And he had very close ties with the Bush family.
Bush family,
That they used to call him Bandar Bush.
Bandar Bush. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this guy in 2013, he became the head of the intelligence in Saudi Arabia. So mm-hmm. he implemented the American neocon plan in Syria because they told him the Qataris failed between 2011 to 2013. Now the Saudis have to intervene strongly and remove Assad from power. So they asked for Bandar bin Sultan to come back to intelligence life this time. And mm-hmm. the guy came and he asked $2 trillion from the Arabic countries to allocate $2 trillion to remove Assad from power. And this was according to the former foreign minister of Qatar, Hamad bin Jassim. Like when you connect all this information together, I feel like I want to run away, you know, like,
it's even more than what you laid out. So when WikiLeaks released like Hillary Clinton's emails, when she was Secretary of State, she explicitly says we need to support the Syrian rebels and foment that situation in Syria specifically for the benefit of Israel. She's very explicit that it's to benefit Israel specifically. So the whole neocon thing is not exclusive to the Republican Party at all. And was a major guiding, was a major guide in terms of how Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, saw the situation as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. She said, if a Shia-Sunni war erupts in Syria, this will be for the benefit of Israel in these leaked emails. And then Jack Sullivan, he was the advisor for Hillary Clinton, who is now the National Security Advisor. Mm-hmm. He said, Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. I mean,
yes. mm-hmm.
shall I continue, guys? You know, like, it's pretty obvious, right? And in this case, I want, because you mentioned correctly that there is no really difference between the New York and the Democrats when it comes to these vital issues. And nowadays we can see that there is almost a consensus among the Democrats and the Republicans on supporting Israel. Mm-hmm. One may wonder how much of this support to Israel, among other factors, is due to blackmail operations similar to what Jeffrey Epstein was accused of doing on behalf of the Mossad by compromising politicians, heads of state, mm-hmm. and public figures with sex tapes on his island. For example, one of the examples that you mentioned or hinted, let's say, on X, it is RFK. I mean, personally, I watch RFK for a few years now. I feel like the guy is just like really solid arguments. And then when it comes to Israel, you feel like his brain's flipped, you know, something yes. happened to his brain.
His tone is different. The way he speaks is different. It's faster. It's like he's more stressed out when he's talking about it. I mean, there are definite dialectic changes when the issue becomes Israel specifically. And oddly enough, you know, that is his position on Israel specifically, you know, Israel-Palestine issues is just so far removed from a lot of his other rhetoric about other things. The idea about, you know, being anti-war, not supporting endless war, but it's fine if, you know, the U.S. gives a bunch of money for Israel for war or goes to war for Israel's benefit. You know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense, claiming to be against fascism when honestly there is no party in power today that is more fascist than Likud. I mean, which literally came out of Irgun and the Stern Gang, yeah. paramilitary groups, which, you know, in the case of the Stern Gang, describe themselves as terrorist groups. RFK knows the history of the Stern Gang, by the way, because I talked to him about it. And those groups were specifically, they were created by Zev Jabotinsky, who was directly inspired by Mussolini fascism. Hmm. That is where Likud comes from. It is an ethno-fascist party and has been from its inception. And it's been the dominant force in Israeli politics for a long time. And so you're at this point now where being against, not even being anti-Zionist, but being anti-Likud, because remember, in early Zionism, labor Zionism was the dominant movement. And they, many labor Zionists argued for equal rights for Arabs and for Palestinians. Yeah. And now it's Likud, which is mm-hmm. against that. Yeah. Entirely, and you know, in his for ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and if you're against that, you're anti-Semitic now. It doesn't make any sense, honestly. It's not just a conflation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. It's a conflation of anti-Likud party policy. Yes. Or even, you know, some of these more extremist parties that are in the coalition. Being against them is now being considered anti-Semitic. It's completely insane. And RFK should absolutely be aware of that. And the fact that he's not and essentially chaperoned by someone like Rabbi Shmuley, who is deeply intertwined with the Adelson family, speaks volumes to me. Sheldon Adelson was Trump's biggest donor. He was the guy that got Trump to take on John Bolton as national security advisor and fire H.R. McMaster from that post. He was the guy that got Trump to move the embassy to Jerusalem. He's on video. Well, Sheldon Adelson's dead now, but he was on video saying all he cares about is being a good citizen of Israel. Very overt about where his loyalties lie. But, you know, of course, you can't talk about it, even though he says it on video. And his wife, Miriam Adelson, you know, now is running, you know, the family's wealth and political donations. Because he was an American, he couldn't donate beyond a certain amount to Likud and to Netanyahu. So he created unprofitable media enterprises in Israel to sway public opinion in favor of Likud and Netanyahu. That's who Rabbi Shmuley is intimately interfaced with. And that is not the kind of figure that RFK projects himself as being affiliated with, but he is on these occasions. And he's also, you know, posing under portraits of Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who is the Rebbe of the Chabad Lubavitch movement, now deceased. And the Chabad Lubavitch movement, of course, deeply tied to Trump world as well, is a very controversial movement because it's very apocalyptic, it's messianic, and has this this viewpoint about specific actions need to be made to happen in the Middle East to fulfill biblical prophecies, because we can't wait for God to fulfill them. We have to put it in motion so that these prophecies are fulfilled. And Netanyahu is very much tied up in those circles as well, because he was told by this particular Rebbe that he would be the last leader of Israel before the Moshiach, yes. the Jewish Messiah, comes. And, you know, even if you listen to popular influencers that are Jewish in the U.S., for example, like Ben Shapiro, describe the Moshiach as a military leader, not like a messianic figure like Jesus Christ is in the Christian religion. It's a military leader that, you know, basically creates a dictatorship in Israel. So that will be interesting to see how that plays out. But it's very disappointing to see RFK, you know, espousing positions that I don't think he normally would, as someone that has dedicated his life ostensibly to children's health. He can't call out the bombing of hospitals, the murder of infants on in incubators and ventilators in Gaza. It doesn't make any sense. And the idea to act like, you know, Palestinians are all raised to hate, you know, Jews from birth, and all of these very easily debunked Hasbara talking points. You know, I mean, honestly, it's just beyond disappointing. And people have, of course, speculated that, you know, RFK's connections to Epstein in the early 90s may have something to do with this. And it's definitely within the realm of possibility. But of course, you know, there isn't any direct evidence for that beyond the flight logs. And you either have to believe what RFK says about it. You can't ask Epstein. You can't ask RFK's former wife, who is now deceased, who was, you know, allegedly there. It would come down to Ghislaine Maxwell versus RFK, what really happened on the plane. And he claims that he was with his children both times, and that it was, you know, for different purposes. I don't know. I mean, again, it's very hard to know. But I definitely, given his stance on Israel, since it's become a big part of his campaign, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't really see it as his genuine viewpoint, if his other viewpoints are indeed genuine about being anti-war and anti-fascist and all of that. But, you know, RFK is someone who has a very checkered history, and he's been very open about that, having past issues with drug addiction and been engaged in, you know, immoral activities in his youth and whatever. So, I mean, if they wanted to blackmail him with something, it wouldn't necessarily have to have been Epstein that did it. And Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell weren't specifically, it's not like everyone they encountered and had on their plane was a pedophile. You know, Epstein was also a very prolific financial criminal and involved in a lot of other aspects that were criminal as well. Arms trade, for example, and people he engaged with in that, you know, yes, there's illicit business ties, but it doesn't mean everyone that interacted with him in those spheres is automatically a pedophile. You know, when people want to are engaged in influence operations like Maxwell and Epstein were, they study their targets and they find the best way to influence and control them. And it's not always not everyone is going to be easily coerced into a sexual situation with a 14-year-old. You know, they may be more easily influenced and controlled by other means. And, you know, these people study their targets and then actualize on that. And as I've noted on my reporting before, Ghislaine Maxwell was very focused, not just on RFK Jr., but the Kennedy family in particular. She was a guest at Carrie Kennedy's wedding, was RFK Jr.'s sister, very close with her. Carrie Kennedy's best friend was RFK Jr.'s ex-wife, Mary Richardson, who was good friends with Ghislaine Maxwell, and allegedly how Ghislaine got into the Kennedy network. There's pictures of her flirting with RFK Jr.'s older brother. You know, apparently Robert Maxwell wanted Ghislaine Maxwell to marry a Kennedy before he died. So there was a lot of interest there in sort of influencing the Kennedy family in particular. Did they get that from RFK or by other means? Again, it's hard to know exactly how it may have happened, though. I found out after I wrote my book that in 2014 or so, if you look on Getty Image Search and you look for RFK Jr., you will find that he was in Ghislaine Maxwell's apartment for some sort of environmental event when she was in her Terramar days. So it's not something that just, you know, happened in the early 90s. They had some sort of affiliation later on, but it could have been minimal. Again, he hasn't been very open about, I mean, he's only spoken about the flight logs. He hasn't talked about other interactions with Ghislaine Maxwell, but there's photographs of him at her apartment well beyond that date. And of course, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, is, you know, probably one of the most influential and consequential Israeli intelligence assets ever. In terms of the promise scandal, but, you know, story for another time.
Yeah. Time will tell or will not. We will see in the near future. But till then, Whitney Webb, I'm wholeheartedly thankful for you for coming to my show and sharing your insights, valuable insights with me first and with the audience of Syriana Analysis. I'm not someone who is interviewing you. I'm also a fan. Guys, her links for her work and also the book One Nation Under Blackmail is in the description below. You can see, you can go and read her work and also purchase the book. And also, if you like to support this work, you can share it with your friends. And there are so many means also in the description below. You know it well, like you watch Syrian Analysis for quite some time. But Whitney, thank you so much again for being my guest. Really, it's a really pleasure.
Thanks. It was my pleasure as well. Take care.